You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I am Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Dr. Una Osili, who is the Associate Dean of Research and International Programs at the Indiana Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And we're so pleased to have Dr. Osili with us today because among her responsibilities is the production of the Giving Report. That's right, the USA Giving Report that we all depend on to gather together information on how we're doing with philanthropy in the United States. Dr. Osili, it's wonderful to have you with us today, and we're going to cover quite a bit of information about what you do and what that may mean for our sector and for people who like to give to charities. Welcome, Dr. Osili.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to join today and looking forward to the conversation.
Well, Una, I've really been looking forward to having you on the show because you are a unique and important piece of our nonprofit infrastructure because you help us gather and make sense of the information that helps us understand the nonprofit sector, particularly around giving and donating to charitable organizations. And so today, I hope we can have a pretty wide-ranging and open conversation about what you're seeing in terms of trends in giving and some of the latest information that you've gathered on how individuals and institutions are donating to charitable organizations. So let's just get started by asking first just a little bit about your background and what sort of led you to this sort of chunk of the nonprofit sector.
Well, thanks so much for that question. It's always fun to reflect on the whole journey. I was born in New York City and grew up in Nigeria. My mother is American. My father's Nigerian. So I grew up with two very different but very important models of generosity. My father was very generous. He educated his siblings and all his relatives, paid for them to go to school, and taught us the importance of lifting up and giving to others. And my mother introduced us to formal opportunities to give and volunteer. As young kids, we volunteered at various neighborhood institutions, including a senior citizen's home. And at the time, it was called a motherless baby's home at very young ages. So I grew up with important models of generosity. And fast forward the tape, when I got to college and in grad school, I had the opportunity to be involved in the nonprofit sector. As a graduate student, I obtained a PhD in economics, and my dissertation looked at collecting data about immigrants to the U.S. and how they were involved in giving back to their countries of origin. So that led me to really a career focused on data in philanthropy. One challenge, as you may realize, is that that is still a new area of philanthropy that's still emerging. We have, in the past decade in particular, made a lot of progress on collecting data on new forms of giving in particular, but there's still a lot of questions that remain to be answered. At the Lilly Family School, we host a number of large-scale research projects. Giving USA is one of them, but we also have the Global Philanthropy Indices, which look at philanthropy in more than 80 countries. So I think if you take both of those projects and look at them in their broadest scale, broadest scope, you realize, one, that we've made a lot of progress in data. And I feel pretty excited about the future because there's so many new areas yet to discover.
Well, that's wonderful. Una, you know, you bring up a really important point that this is still something new, that is the gathering and disseminating of information on a broad scale about the nonprofit sector. And we've still got a long way to go, obviously. But what do you see as some of the barriers? What has sort of held us back in terms of having, you know, robust and reliable data and information on how we're doing collectively as a sector to change society in different ways?
It's a great question. One way to answer that is to take us back to where we started from, in particular with Giving USA. Giving USA is the longest running research project on charitable giving in the US and possibly in the world. It dates back to the 1950s. And then another project that we have here at the school is the Philanthropy Panel Study, which is the largest and most comprehensive study of American philanthropy because it follows the same families, about 10,000 families, a representative sample of all Americans, and we have a lot of information about their giving. So if you look at these two projects, you can get a bit of a snapshot of what progress we've made, but also, as you mentioned, what holds us back. I think really what has held us back is that to collect this data requires sustained effort and resources and also rethinking, because as giving changes, the way we approach it has to be tweaked and modified. And that ongoing resource commitment is something we take for granted. But if we look at a lot of the other sectors of our economy, the government plays a big role in collecting that data, or there is a third party infrastructure organization that's allocated to that. When it comes to philanthropy, because of its very nature, it's the voluntary sector, the third sector, the impact sector. We don't necessarily have one group of individuals or one institution that is tasked with collecting that data. What we've seen over time is that there are organizations that might step in and start a project, but then over a few years where maybe funding priorities change or the institutional priorities change, that project then falls by the wayside. One advantage that universities have in this process of data collection and stewardship over time is that universities are here for the long haul for the most part. Many of them have capacity, have graduate students and faculty who can be dedicated to a project. So that's what really distinguishes the role that universities can play in this. And I am very, very hopeful about the future because we're starting to see these partnerships evolve. So one example I mentioned already with Giving USA is that Indiana University has a partnership with the Giving USA Foundation, and this has been sustained over two plus decades. The Philanthropy Panel Study is housed at University of Michigan. And so it's a collaborative effort with the Lilly Family School. And just to give you a quick backstory about that project, it was started by the U.S. government under the Johnson administration as part of the War on Poverty. So the government provided the initial funding, and it's still funded by the NSF, the National Science Foundation, NICHD, NIA, many federal agencies, with the school and many of its private funders being the only private funder currently of the panel study of income dynamics. So I know I've thrown out a lot of different ideas here.
No, yes. it's important to try to get some background on this. You mentioned one thing that I had to chuckle about. I remember, right after the economic crash that we had in around 2008 or so, we decided that we would try to understand how charities were faring and asked some of the organizations that we were accrediting to send us information on how they were doing through in the middle of the year from a revenue standpoint. And, you know, I thought this would be a pretty straightforward project. You know, just send me some sense of what you're doing from a fundraising standpoint. And we're about 6 months into the year. Just give me a sense of that. Well, it was really a challenge because many organizations don't account for how they get revenue the same way. Some of them have different reporting periods. Some collect that data every month For others, it lagged several months, and it was a trip. You know, it was really. So when you say that, you know, people try these things and they suddenly stop doing it, I think there are lots of reasons why they stop. But the most important one is certainly what you mentioned, is that, you know, you need an organization that is robust enough and is going to be around. But it's also very challenging to get similar data from organizations that you can use to compare and make sense of it. So kudos to what you all have been doing all these years to help us understand what's going on. Well, let's talk about the latest data on giving. I know there's been a lot of discussion about it. It looks like we have raised significantly more money than we have in the past, this last year. And yet there are some concerns that we see in this data as well, as relates to the number of families donating to charitable organizations. You want to talk about that some?
Yes, and thank you for mentioning that. This is where longitudinal data, this long-term sustained effort, really starts to pay off. And that's because the school has been tracking giving, as I mentioned, for more than two decades. In fact, the philanthropy panel study was the first project that I worked on as a young assistant professor straight out of graduate school, along with many colleagues here at the Lilly Family School. So at the beginning of the 21st century, what we noted was that two-thirds of Americans gave to charitable organizations. That's a very impressive number, because what it tells us even today is that a majority of Americans give, and that giving is by far the most common civic activity that all of us as Americans participate in. In fact, you could go as far as to say that generosity is a core value for Americans across the board, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, their origins, and so forth. However, beginning around the time of the Great Recession, we saw a trend that concerned a lot of us, where we start to see giving dip. It fell. And then at this point, the latest data we have is before the pandemic, so 2019, we now have less than half of Americans that are giving to charity. Now, this is of concern because in the past, giving has been stable through economic downturns, through disasters, through national crises. We've seen Americans continue to give. But during the Great Recession, we start to see that picture change, where younger Americans and Americans with lower incomes and less wealth started to participate less frequently in the charitable sector. And that trend, I think, is what we have called broadly dollars up or holding steady, but donors down. Or you could say donors down, but dollars are up or holding steady. Now, we have just seen the past 2 years of a global health crisis, a global pandemic, where there has been incredible generosity. So the overall numbers show Americans giving in new ways and show that communities have really stepped up their generosity. In addition to the big picture, our Giving USA aggregate data show giving reaching a new record with over $470 billion being given. So how do you reconcile those two? Big picture, giving is growing, people are engaged. But then when we drill down into the micro data, what's important to note is that there is a segment of our society that has begun to show signs of not giving, not participating. And it's especially of concern because our younger Americans are less likely to give, even when we adjust for life cycle and income and age and many other factors that affect giving. So the takeaway here is that as we start to recover from the global pandemic, there are signs that generosity is on the rise, and we are hopeful that some of these initial trends brought about by the Great Recession can start to be reversed. But it's going to take action from all of us, nonprofits, institutions, policymakers, to make sure that every segment of our society is engaged in the charitable sector. And we cannot just focus on people who are giving currently, but also look at who has stopped giving and who is likely to return to giving. And so as we think about what this means for the nonprofit sector, I think there is a call to action. All of us have a role to play in this to ensure that giving continues to be inclusive and continues to be a place where every American can participate.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I don't know if we actually have a true handle on why people aren't giving in the same, to the same level that they were giving in the past. But there are a number of changes that have gone on in our society in the last 20 years that could account for some of this. I'm just curious to know if you would agree or not, or if there's any data to support it. But one of the things that I grew up with, at least from the time I started working, was organizations that had robust United Way campaigns. And I know friends of mine who worked in government had similar campaigns with the combined federal campaign, where people would literally come around to your desk and ask you, how much are you going to give this year to this particular campaign that we have with the United Way? And departments within organizations would actually compete to see which department was going to have the most pledges to nonprofits in a particular year to the United Way. And we had that engine that was right there in front of us that was sort of reminding us and in some cases prodding us to break off a little piece of our salary every paycheck and give something to the United Way. And many of us didn't have a lot to give, but you know, you might have given $5 out of your paycheck. So that would have accounted for larger numbers of smaller donations. And I am certain that the United Way isn't able, for one thing, to go after donations in the same way that they did in the past. And so I wonder if that affects it. That's one thing. The second thing, Una, I'm just curious to see if you would agree or not, is that as our society grows increasingly diverse, I don't know if charities have figured out how to reach many of these diverse groups. And so even though surveys say that people from diverse backgrounds would give more if asked, I wonder if charities are actually extending themselves to understand how to appeal to these groups to get those donations. And the last thing I'll say is that from my, you know, somewhat limited observations, it seems to me that development offices in charities are going after large donors. They're spending a lot more time and energy trying to get large donations from people who are in a position to give that money. And they're spending less time trying to cultivate large numbers of small donations. And so there's no surprise that we see fewer people giving. If we're not asking them, they're not certainly going to give. I'm just curious what you think about all of that.
Wow, you've covered a lot of ground, some great points. I want to start with the data. So we have had the opportunity to do some deeper dives, not just noting these overall trends, but exploring why these trends are taking place. And what we found is that about half of that decline in giving can be attributed broadly to economic factors, lower wages, incomes, wealth, those types of factors. But fully half of that decline in giving is not explained by just economic factors. So there are a lot of other issues that come up, such as trust and confidence in the nonprofit sector. Also religious affiliation, a point that we have to stress. Religiously affiliated Americans give more, not just to religious charities, but to charity overall. So with that as a backdrop, let's do a deeper dive into some of the factors you've mentioned. One of those is that we have noted in the data that giving to umbrella organizations has actually declined very significantly. It's one of the areas where we're seeing some of the fastest declines in giving. And that relates perhaps to overall trust in the nonprofit sector. In the past, many American households were confident in the nonprofit sector, higher levels of trust, And what they did was they allocated their giving to an institution such as the United Way, United Jewish Appeals, and let that organization disperse the funding to other nonprofits. Well, with lower levels of trust, more donors want to know where their dollars are going, and they're more interested in actually connecting to the causes that they care about rather than working with an intermediary of a different type. And so this is what you might link more broadly to declining trust in institutions. When people trust institutions less, they're less likely to give to those umbrella organizations and instead want to allocate their giving to specific nonprofits. So I think you're correct in assessing that declining giving to umbrella organizations such as the United Way can be part of the explanation. But I would sort of urge that we need to look a little bit deeper and look at why that's happening. And trust in nonprofits is part of that. And that is also an area where all of us can work to build that trust in the nonprofit sector. The other point you raised about diversity is also worth a deeper dive. When we look at the data, we see that Americans, regardless of their race, ethnicity, background, are just as likely to give. So although racial disparities are present in other parts of our society, when it comes to giving, we see that Americans give regardless of their race. And in fact, once we adjust for incomes and education levels and wealth levels, we see very similar giving rates. However, it is true that communities of color are often less likely to be approached by fundraisers. From our data, we know that the number one reason people often give is because someone asked them to give. And when it comes to giving and also volunteering, nonprofits struggle to connect with communities of color. What this means is that when we look at a lot of our mainstream institutions, higher education, arts and culture, they are really facing challenges when it comes to engaging diverse donors. And that's because they often do not have practices in place or traditions in place when it comes to engaging communities of color. And that's where I think a lot of work needs to be done as our country becomes more diverse. Our institutions are more diverse. The development offices also need to transform their own practices so they can meet the donors of today. It may mean that one size does not fit all what worked in the past. In other words, if you're reaching a more diverse donor base, you may need to think about new ways of engaging those donors. One very simple example, I've often had conversations with development organization agencies or institutions at higher educational institutions, and they say, you know, our diverse donors do not attend tailgate parties. Well, what are some other things you could offer to them if they don't want to attend the tailgate parties? Have you considered, for example, cultural offerings, lectures, dance engagements, other ways of reaching those donors? So one approach is not going to work for everyone. And it may be worth reaching out to those communities to find out what they would like to be, how they would like to be engaged. And the good news today is that there's so many tools, both virtual and in-person opportunities, given the diversity of the landscape that is today's American donor.
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite a challenge for development offices, because if you are in that role, if you're head development person in an organization, your objectives are the easiest one to track and count. You know, did we hit our goal of raising what we wanted to raise this year? And if a development person knows that on their list, they have three people who can, you know, deliver significant chunks of that money, they're going to spend a lot of time making sure that money comes in. And there may not be the same incentive to build programs that broaden their base if especially people are monitoring costs and expenses that it takes to bring in that money. So it'll be a challenge, but I think our sector is somewhat dependent on its ability to drive people to give and contribute from all walks of life. And I'm just curious what you think about our nation. What will become of our nation if we're not able to change this trend where we see now, I guess, almost a 17% decline in the number of families giving to philanthropic organizations over the last 20 years, or was it about 18 years or so? What do you think we can expect if this trend continues?
Well, let me just start by saying that there's both a challenge and an opportunity. So when we look at our diverse donors, starting there, what is the opportunity there is that donors of color, donors of all backgrounds, are very much interested in the philanthropic sector. When we adjust for income and wealth, they have just as high giving rates as anyone else. And so the opportunity is that these are donors that have not been engaged in the past and often are open to those engagement opportunities. And let me give you a very concrete example. At Indiana University, we have a Black Philanthropy Council. And what this has entailed is actually reaching out to African-American alums who have never been asked, at least as major donors, by the university in the past. And many of them have stepped up and also allowed themselves to be part of this community, reaching out to other potential donors, actually making it easier for the development office because they are out there talking to their friends and their network within their own networks. Similarly, we have a new initiative. This is called the Queer Philanthropy Council, QPC, and this is engaging members of the LGBTQ community. Many of them also have not been involved as major donors in the past. So this is a new, brand new group. They aren't new to giving, but they're new to giving to Indiana University just because no one has approached them in the past. So what I'd like to emphasize is that while we do have these challenges within the data also show an enormous opportunity if organizations align with the demographics that are in play, they can actually have a tremendous success. And the good news here is that they can be pioneers in actually establishing and building relationships with these diverse donors. So I'm really excited about this opportunity because there's a business case here as well as a really exciting opportunity to infuse your current donor base with many donors who previously you have not engaged with or even heard from. So I'll just say that as an aside. And as we look at our future, if we look at American history, even from its very beginnings, before there was an America, there were philanthropic institutions. Our colleges and universities, one example, Harvard existed before the United States did, and it was a product of philanthropy, a bequest that was left for the university. So what is very hopeful is when we look at our arts and culture institutions, the Smithsonian, our colleges and universities, our hospitals, many community grassroots organizations, everything from the NAACP to the Urban League, they have benefited from an infusion of not just giving of money, but also of our time, of our talents, and now of our testimony, our words. So as we think about what's at stake here, it's really the health and strength of our democracy as we continue to engage individuals of all backgrounds in philanthropic institutions. We build the future of our country where we depend on not just the government or the business sector, but also civil society and the nonprofit sector to infuse our communities with providing a safety net, with the arts and culture, but also with the, you might think, public goods that many of us rely on, whether it's higher education, disaster relief, healthcare. So I think what has made America, you know, there are many ways of looking at what has made America such an exceptional, whether you believe in American exceptionalism or not, the trajectory of this country has in fact been shaped by civil society institutions. If you go back to Tocqueville, everyone always cites his observation, but when you put the lens of movements, civil rights movement, our current racial and social justice movement, nonprofits and philanthropy have played a pivotal role. So I think we are all aware of what's at stake. And I think we need to once again roll up our sleeves and think about how we can engage all Americans in the philanthropic sector going forward. And for the nonprofit sector, it's worth asking not just who's at the table when it comes to major gifts or recruiting volunteers, but who's not at the table? Who have we not typically engaged with? And those voices are just as important. Given that we are all virtual for the most part and we're learning how to operate in hybrid settings, this is also a good time to think about with technology, who can we reach that we couldn't reach before? and who may have challenges engaging with us on these virtual platforms. So this is not just a time of challenge, but I want to emphasize the opportunities that exist for the philanthropic sector, for the nonprofit sector as a whole.
Fantastic. Una, now you and I are connected to something called the Generosity Commission, which has a mission to sort of look into some of the challenges. I am co-chairing the Policy and Government Relations Work Group for the Generosity Commission, along with my friend John Tyler from the Kauffman Foundation. And we have a robust group of people who will be working over the course of the next couple of years to try to get some answers around what we can do from a policy standpoint to change the shift, the trajectory of family giving. And really looking forward to working with those folk. And what can you say about the Generosity Commission to help our listeners really understand what that group is about and how it came about?
Well, it's very interesting that you raise the policy dimension, because as we've talked about giving, what drives giving, what factors influence giving, we've sort of left out the role of policy so far. But it's important to note that giving is, of course, a complex decision. People give when they have the resources to give, the income, the wealth, when they're asked to give. But that policy, especially tax code in particular, can influence the timing of the gift, the amount, and the mechanisms, the vehicles that people use for making their charitable donations. One thing we have been looking at very closely at the Lilly Family School is the role that tax policy has played over time in charitable decisions. In 2017, as many of you know, we enacted the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA. And what I think most people probably recognize is that it did change the structure of the incentives that many Americans face around their charitable giving. In particular, it reduces the recognition that a lot of Americans receive for their tax contributions, because prior to tax reform, about a third of Americans itemized on their taxes, which means that when we look at our taxes, many more Americans were able to be recognized for their generosity within the tax code. Fast forward post TCJA, that percentage has dropped down to about 10% of Americans who are currently itemizing, and therefore less than 10%, so a minority now, a small minority of Americans who are actually receiving tax recognition for their charitable giving. So as we look ahead, one of the, I think, hopeful signs is that with some of the intervention that we had, the CARES Act in 2020, there was this attempt by the U.S. government to start to expand the recognition that more and more Americans are receiving with the 2020 CARES Act for their tax contributions. And I think that's important because the charitable deduction is one of the oldest parts of the U.S. Tax code in terms of income tax. It's been around for more than 100 years. And it's also been very broad-based, meaning Americans of different backgrounds can actually itemize, receive a deduction for their charitable giving. And I think going forward, especially for younger Americans, that has been a way of kind of learning about the importance of the charitable sector, what makes charitable giving unique. And so I guess looking ahead as far as policy proposals, that's certainly an area that I think there is a need for more action and closer look at how we can continue to find ways within the U.S. tax code to provide that recognition for generosity.
So one of the other things I was thinking about, in addition to the tax issue, which is a big one, I think, I don't know if we know yet what the impact of the tax change on the deductibility change will have on individual giving, particularly people who made lots of small gifts. I don't know what that will be, but it seems to me that in addition to maybe trying to preserve that in some way, we got to think about other kinds of incentives. And the government incentives are important, but I wonder if there are other kinds of incentives that we might produce. We created something that I think you know about called givesafely.io. And the whole intention of Give Safely was to try to provide some incentives for people to give to charities by offering them a deeper experience with a charity if they made a donation through that portal. And since people seem to be wanting these closer connections to the things that they give to, we're hopeful that those kinds of opportunities might also provide incentives for people to give. I mean, there are lots of reasons why people give. People give for simply because it feels good. I know we know there's some dopamine that you get when you make a gift. There's religious reasons why a person might give. People are humanitarian. They might give because they want to see everybody have the same opportunity for success in life. So there are lots of reasons why people give. And you mentioned the whole issue of trust. Maybe if we can bring organizations and charities closer together, we can help with that. And, you know, charities in many ways are intermediaries. You know, they connect us to causes that we care about. They do a lot of the work, so we don't have to. But it seems that in order to really give robustly to an organization, we want to feel that we're in that work with the organization, and maybe incentives that enable that to occur could be helpful. But I'm curious what you think about other types of incentives we might provide that make younger people in particularly feel not only that they should be generous, that is giving to friends and families and other things in their communities that aren't connected to a charity, but also giving to charitable entities as well.
There's so much work to be done here. I'm not even sure where to start, but I'll just mention a few ideas because this is a time of a lot of experimentation. Technology in particular can be, I think you mentioned the platform you all have at Wise Giving Alliance. We have developed a new tool at the Lilly Family School called the Give-O-Meter. And what that does, it allows you to measure your giving and see how your giving stacks up to your peers, people in the same income group or wealth group or even education and region. And what we found is that social information matters. For some donors, they may be interested in giving. They're not sure what the norms are. And while it's easy to get data on other topics when it comes to giving, as we've noted, the data tends to be scarce. I think there's also an opportunity to tap into some of the behavioral insights that we've seen in other fields across the board, whether it's healthcare, politics, sports, and entertainment. We're seeing data kind of transform the landscape. And here I think we have an opportunity to do that within the giving realm. And some examples that we have been exploring here at the Lilly Family School are these models around subscription-based models. So rather than, and this has worked in the past for some organizations, rather than asking a donor for a one-time gift, perhaps signing up for a monthly gift, where this has worked for Netflix and many other commercial giants in our country and our world, nonprofits are starting to experiment with these and having some success. So we have actually partnered with Network for Good to explore what leads some donors to sign up in this way. Can we understand more about those motivations? And similarly, what about the donors who just want to give one-time gifts? Are there other ways to engage them? So I think we have, once again, a wealth of opportunity. And with technology, especially for younger donors, how to make this a fun experience. During the pandemic, one of our research partners, the CDC Foundation, we learned a lot from them because at the beginning of the pandemic, they launched a new crowdfunding campaign on a platform I had not heard of until now called charity.com. They were able to raise $50 million in just the space of a month using some new methods, crowdfunding, but also new partners. TikTok was one of their partners, and younger donors were able to create videos and at the same time make donations. In addition, they had gamers, virtual gamers that signed up to raise money. What we have today are a wealth of new tools, and in order to reach our young donors, especially those younger donors who are under 30, we need to also think about what do those new donors care about, what kinds of causes matter to them, and also what new tools resonate with them. many of them ask, can I give through Venmo or can I give through my PayPal account? Do nonprofits have those options, those digital tools and options on their websites that make it easier for donors to give? So my big push right now is, what are the barriers that exist when it comes to charitable giving? Who is not at the table? How can we ensure that we make it easy and accessible and fun to give? As you noted, there's a joy in giving. And increasingly, what we've seen, especially with COVID and so many challenges around us, is that giving can be a way for many families, many communities to feel a sense of agency and hope during these very challenging times, and providing those opportunities to give not just financially, but also to give of your time, your advocacy, and so many of the other talents that Americans of all backgrounds have to give right now.
Fantastic. Well, Una, we're getting to the end of the interview, but I have to ask you what you're seeing as a result of COVID. You know, the nonprofit sector had to make a really quick shift to virtual activity. Many organizations depended and to some extent still depend on events to raise funds for their organization. Some organizations, for instance, get up to 30 to 40% of their donations from events, in-person events. And many of those events, of course, couldn't take place because of COVID. Other groups like the YMCA, which is a place-based sort of service model, had to shut down. And I'm just curious what you think if COVID continues, and it looks unfortunately like we're going to be in for another round of this. How do you see organizations faring? Do you expect that donors will continue to support organizations even though they can't participate in those in-person events? I'm hopeful, of course, that they will. There were some signs that they did last time around, and maybe we can hope for that this time. But are you also seeing any innovation from charities to try to keep those donors engaged even though they can't have these events as much?
Lots to unpack with that question. Just note, in addition to the global pandemic, we've also had a racial and social justice movement. We've had an economic crisis on a scale that none of us have actually experienced. We'd have to go back even 100 years more, you know, during the Great Depression to see sort of indicators of the magnitude that we've experienced in 2020 in particular. So as we fast forward to where we are now, it's a new year, 2022, and there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And let me start with those. First of all, the economy has rebounded in a way that I think few expected. And even if we look at the outlook for 2022, the International Monetary Fund has actually projected a positive growth rate for 2022. The stock market, financial markets have performed at record levels in the past year, and that bodes well for charitable giving. On the, I think, challenges ahead, we should note that labor markets have continued to be a bit of a constraint for many nonprofits as they seek to hire talent in the fundraising area and so many other areas. They've had to compete because wages are increasing. Nonprofits are also dealing with higher inflation rates. At the same time, this is a time where we've seen a lot of innovation. You mentioned in-person events. Organizations have learned how to reach virtual audiences and expand their footprint through those virtual tools. So innovation, resilience, creativity have been important assets of the nonprofit sector. And I think more innovation is going to be needed as we look at 2022, where organizations will have to learn how to build relationships with donors, how to engage donors in new ways, and how to maintain that personal connection. Because ultimately, what leads to sustained giving is that engagement. And this is a time when, despite all the challenges that I've identified, donors are looking for those connections. So I think it's a time to be certainly very hopeful, but also aware that we will need continued innovation. We'll need to essentially think through what works now, because what worked in the past may not work in this environment, but organizations have a lot to be, I think, optimistic about.
Well, yeah, that's great. And, you know, I'm also wishing the best for our friends in arts organizations and others that, again, they depend on being able to gather folk. And, you know, all we can do is really encourage people who've traditionally supported organizations like this to continue their support. In some ways, you know, your gift may actually accomplish more, because if you were depending on going to an event in order for the organization to generate revenue and the event's not taking place, there's no cost associated with that for the organization. So your gift means a lot more. Well, Una, we could go on for, I don't know, indefinitely. There's so much to talk about. And maybe we can get you back on the podcast another round later in the year as things continue to unfold. But I am so grateful for the work that you do. I am truly grateful for your friendship over all these years. And I just hope people can appreciate how important a role it is that you and your colleagues at the Lilly School play to make sure that we have valuable and information that we can actually use to make sense of what's going on in the nonprofit sector and help us better connect with donors.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure. I also want to thank all of you at the Wise Giving Alliance for the work you do. And of course, acknowledge our fantastic team at the Lilly Family School and all my colleagues here at the school and throughout the sector, our research partners such as the Giving USA Foundation and so many others. The importance of this research relies on all this collaborative work. So thank you.
So thanks to all of you for listening to this episode with Una Osili. And I hope you will check into some of our other podcast episodes by going to any of the major podcast platforms. And you can also support the podcast by going to give.org and making a donation. Or you can find us also on Patreon. Thanks for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.